Hello, and welcome to I Am the Egg Pod, with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by two guests, director, producer and filmmaker Chris Purcell, and writer and author Martin Ruddock. Hello.
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 So that's Martin speaking first, and then Chris second, just so you know who's who.
Thanks very much, Chris, for having me. I'm such a fan of the Egg Pod, and it's a great privilege to actually be on it, chatting about my favourite thing in the world.
Thank you. Lovely to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. I mean, I've adored Egg Pod since it started. It's just such a breath of fresh air, and it's really lovely to be involved. I've wanted to talk about Hollywood Bowl for ages, and it's lovely to do.
Thank you. I'm a big fan of both your work as well, so thank you so much. So can I ask firstly, if I start with you, Chris, when did you first discover the Beatles?
Well, I think that probably all started around 1970. So I'm 54. My parents were both from Liverpool, so a big sort of Liverpool connection there. And I have a very vivid memory, not the Beatles actually, the first one was The Scaffold being played on a radiogram. Remember those?
Oh, yes.
And so that was obviously Paul's brother Mike and Roger McGough and John Gorman. But my dad was a newspaper journalist and interviewed them.
Oh, wow.
My elder brother had the White Album in, I think, about 1970, and we shared a bedroom. And I just had... This was on all the time, and I just found it, you know, really entrancing. Particularly weirdly Wild Honey Pie.
Really?
5-year-old. Out of all the tracks.
As entry points go.
Yeah. That's a weird one. but yeah, just absolutely loved them ever since. And lots more Beatle connections I could warble on about, but...
There's plenty of time.
Talk, Martin.
Yeah, how about you, Martin?
I'm a kind of, I suppose, I'm 44, but I'm like a third generation Beatles fan, I suppose, because I probably first came across them around about the time of the Love Me Do picture disc coming out. Mm. And I remember the clip being on Top of the Pops. Yeah. So I first discovered them around then. And then a couple of years later, Yellow Submarine was on TV, and me and my brother, little kids, just sat in front of that. And my dad goes, if you enjoyed that, and then pulls a rather careworn copy of Pepper out of a cupboard, complete with cutouts, which didn't last long.
Oh, no.
I know.
Did you cut them out?
I may have had help. I had a younger brother. Younger brothers are excellent accomplices for this kind of thing. If it's behaviour you'd kick yourself for now, but you can go, but he was four. So... But I think that was a bit of a gateway for me, really, because I just plunged straight into them as, you know, a child of 8 or 9. And we used to go on a lot of camping holidays. And basically, to shut the kids up in the car, there would always be a trip to our price to pick up a cassette for the car. And mine would always be a randomly selected Beatles album. And that's how I first heard Hollywood Bowl, because it was... On one trip to Dorset in a caravan holiday, it was the last one on the shelf. So my dad goes, this one will do.
So yeah, so the album that you've both picked today is the 1977 album, The Beatles at the Hollywood Bowl. So firstly, why did you pick this album? And secondly, why did you pick this version over the 2016 Giles Martin remix? Martin.
I suppose I've got a strange affection for this album anyway, because it was picked up on cassette for me on for a camping trip. I sort of made friends with it on a cheap Walkman on a 2-hour road trip. But I think the reason I love this album, and I think the reason I love it is because it's real. It's obviously, you put this album on, it is no frills. It is a lot of screaming. They occasionally sound a bit knackered, but they're absolutely engaged in it. It's basically the Beatles just being the Beatles, and probably the last time they're purely just enjoying being fab Beatles. It's before they've got fed up of touring. It's before they started making records they can't really reproduce live. Mm. You can tell they're into it. They enjoy it. I mean, we'll get onto it when we go through the tracks, but I put this on and it's just half an hour or so of just pure escape. It's like, it's absolutely a time and a place in a single record.
Yeah. What about you, Chris?
Yeah, I think it's very much the same. I mean, I actually got this for Christmas in 1977. So it's quite significant for me because it's the first LP I ever owned. I had cassettes really? Before that, much like you, Martin. but this was quite a moment because I'd also got that Christmas a Binatone stereo record player. Mm. So it's quite a bumper Christmas. And I got this from my brother and stuck it on. I must have played it about six times. And like you were saying, Martin, I just found it kind of so transporting, really, and pored over the sleeve notes and just felt I could picture every moment of it. Weirdly, I've seen footage of it since on YouTube, the 64 version, and it's quite similar to my, Conjuring.
Yeah.
Of it, really, just always loved it, and I think I've had probably about four copies, and I have the remastered version as well. But do feel that sounds, although a lot of the drums are punchier and there is more separation, I think Paul's bass has suffered. I don't know what you guys think, but particularly on, I mean, maybe we'll get onto this, but on She Loves You, you can hear every pluck on the 77 version, and for some reason it's just, I guess while they're enhancing things and it's gone through all that processing, something's gone.
I suppose when you punch things up, some things are always going to be. I mean, I must admit, it's probably, I don't think I've ever listened to it on speakers, the 2016 version. It feels like it's been designed for earbuds, really, it's been designed for on the move. It seems like more of an iTunes album, doesn't it? The way it's been.
Well, you know what? The best listening experience I've had for this, bizarrely, is I have this 1950s Brenel reel-to-reel, and I re-recorded it onto that, and then connected that. So that's a valve machine connected to a sort of subwoofer, so there's a bit more lower end. And that just sounds brilliant because you forgive all of the the limitations of the recording, because you're looking at art working and hearing this sound. That was probably the best I've heard it. I played it today through the hi-fi downstairs, and it's kind of, you do hear, the limitations of it more, I think, if the speakers are too good.
Yeah. You do realise that now you've mentioned that you've got a Brenel, we're going to have to hear what it sounds like backwards.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Thank you, John.
So let's have a bit of backdrop. George Martin, back in 64, wanted to record the Carnegie Hall gigs for a potential album on Capitol, but this was pushed back by the American Federation. So again, during their first US tour, Capitol agreed to record the 23rd of August gig in Los Angeles at the Hollywood Bowl, which was recorded, thankfully for us, on three-track half-inch tape, so we have got a stereo recording. But George said later that he didn't really have much input, and it was quite a bizarre mixing process, so guitars and vocals were often on the same track. And similar situation following year, because they just said it wasn't good enough to release. So they got back together on the 29th and 30th of August 65, and again it was decided that the quality didn't justify an album release. But yeah, so, and they kept going back to it. Even in 71, the tapes were given to Phil Spector to see if an album could be prepared. Thankfully that didn't happen. And then we cut to the mid-70s, where Capitol president Basker Meinen contacted Boyle Gilmore to try and dig out the tapes to give to George Martin. So in January 77, George and Jeff Emmerich started cleaning up the tapes transferring all the 3-track to 24-track tapes. Yeah, there are a few technical issues as well, because Paul McCartney's vocals were inaudible during some of the 65 recordings. But yeah, they worked with those tapes, eventually got approval from the Beatles. John Parent was delighted. George and Ringo, in George's word, were much cooler. And Paul said, "I haven't heard it." So yeah, 77, we suddenly get a live Beatles album in super stereo.
And this is what always gets me about it, because it's really, it kind of sort of emerges from nowhere, doesn't it, in the late 70s. It is that kind of era of stuff like All This and World War II and the Sgt. Pepper movie. It's kind of like the Beatles are still obviously very close to everybody's hearts, but maybe a little bit less so at this point. Am I right thinking this eventually came out partly to kind of like combat the release of the Star Club?
Yes, that's what I'd heard. I'd heard that they put the, I can't remember the record company that put the Star Club recordings out. Oh yeah, that's right. But the it was a reaction to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting what you mentioned, Chris, about the possible release in 71 with Phil Spector being given the tapes, because there's a John interview where he actually seems to think it came out, getting confused with the Beatles in Italy album, which is just like a commemorative souvenir album that looks like a live album because of the cover shot on it.
Yeah.
And wouldn't it be great if that cover shot had been on this album, because, you know, we love it, but it's not the prettiest of Beatles albums, is it?
No, but arguably nicer than the 8 days a week version.
Oh yeah, well, don't get me started on that. That's just writing and men getting off a plane. Yeah, but
that's not great, is it?
No, it's,
that looks more like a music for pleasure album than a music for pleasure album.
Yeah,
that really does.
It's kind of.
Yeah, I was just going to say I've done a bit of background on the bowl if you're interested.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
Yeah. I came across this really obscure film, a 1965 horror movie called Two for a Guillotine. You come across that?
No.
Directed by William Shatner. No, sorry, not William Shatner. By William Conrad.
I would watch a William Shatner film.
No, the guy who went on to become Frank Cannon. Mm. But there is a 5-minute scene in the film that features that shot at the Hollywood Bowl in the daytime, so you get a very good look at it.
Oh, wow.
And it's a really impressive location. I mean, it's as you know, a concentric kind of half dome over the stage, which gave a real focal point. And then you had a reflecting pool, which isn't there anymore. Directly in front of the stage, so that was a useful obstacle for stage invaders, which often happened at Beatle concerts. Okay. We had to get through this pond, and then there's a steeply arrayed terraced seating up the hillside, and all the seating areas are kind of neatly divided by privet hedging, and then you've got. And then you've got travelators going up the outside to take the people up to the higher levels. So it must have looked pretty exotic and, you know, pretty glamorous as a location for the Beatles, given, you know, they played in all sorts of peculiar places. But this was a purpose-built concert venue.
Yeah, one of the, I suppose one of the kind of like most concerty of all concert venues they ever really did, I suppose. I mean,
yeah, definitely.
Like county fairs and that's what they're kind of used to.
Well, that's the other thing I think that strikes me about it. It's actually theatrically lit as well, in a way that most of their other concerts in these tours weren't. You know, they're always under horrible floodlight, you know, stadium lighting. And this, they're actually, you know, the audience is in darkness and they're lit. So just by accident, actually, they ended up playing at a location that looked like it had some stage design considered, whereas all the other places, they had horrible, gaudy banners and chicken wire fencing and God knows what. I would imagine that must have had an impact on them. You know, they must have Must have felt like they were playing somewhere special, and that it was another indicator of their burgeoning success. And they're under this sort of balmy, you know, Californian starry sky. It just must have been... Mm. It was, I think, their first large outdoor gig as well.
Yeah.
So that must have had an impact, you know.
It's a couple of years... Well, it's a few years later, but I suppose the closest you'll get to actually seeing what a gig of that era looks like is there's a film of The Doors at the Hollywood Bowl.
Yes.
And it's very statically filmed. It's literally like four cameras, one of which is apparently manned by Harrison Ford, of all people. But Harrison Ford was a Doors roadie, and in between his various carpentry jobs. So, you know, just knocking up a shed for Herb Alpert or whatever he did at the time. But, he was a Doors roadie, and he apparently mans one of the cameras on that gig. And you don't really... I mean, it's very static. It's like 1, 2, 3, 4. There's like four static cameras in different locations. But you kind of... Mm-hmm. You do get a bit of a sense of the scale and how nice the venue is.
So let's move on to the album, and we start off with track one, an abridged version of Twist and Shout.
It's very much an intro, isn't it? It's very much, hello, we're the Beatles, bang. I remember sort of thinking that the first time I ever heard it. I was like, obviously very familiar with Twist and Shout from my Out of Order cassette of Please Please Me, but it was, it's basically just, hello, we're the Beatles, without further ado, straight into the set. And yeah, it's probably at that point of thinking, how much longer can we get away with actually just shredding John's voice before you've actually even started the set?
Yeah, I absolutely concur with all of that. I mean, just a great opening. It's just over a minute, isn't it? 120
or something.
Yeah. And have you noticed that lovely extra note that they put in the riff? That one.
Yeah.
Mm. I just think that makes a big difference. I also really love the soulful yeah that Paul does right at the end, and made me wonder how many Beatle tracks are hugely enhanced by him doing a high register yeah in them. he's just so great at that.
And that's one of the things that really shines through about this. They are still taking care about their live performances. They're still engaged with it and interested in it. It's not 66 where they're kind of going, oh, should we ever go at paperback writing? Oh, maybe, you know. It's so they are actually building in these little, I mean, as we go through the album, it's become apparent there's little things they've worked up specifically for the live set that they've rehearsed, and they've actually worked at putting in there. They practice. They are still, despite this insane schedule, just still practicing at being a kick-ass live band.
Yeah, well, I think, controversially, I actually prefer some of the versions of the tracks on this album than the studio versions.
I do.
They've been playing Twist and Shout for years by this point, haven't they? And this is from the 65 show.
Yeah.
And there's no sense of it being any less enthusiastically played, I think. You know, it's just it may be a bit more polished, but just as urgent sounding. But I wondered if I could just very quickly talk about the intro, because it includes Bob Eubanks, who's quite key to all of this. So on the bootleg version, you get the full recording of a rather lengthy intro, don't you, with a whole bunch of KRLA, quite hard to say, DJs bantering with the audience and generally getting them worked up. And one of those is a guy called Bob Eubanks, who apparently was an entrepreneurial DJ, owned a string of nightclubs in the LA area, and actually put up his house to raise the money that Brian wanted for the Beatles to play at the Bowl. So maybe we owe him for this.
Wow.
It's $25,000, which he got back within 3 hours when the tickets went on sale. So the fee, by the way, for the second time they played there, when they did two nights, was $95,000. So they put their prices up. But again, Eubanks produced that one as well. And he's a really fascinating guy, still around. Actually, quite surprising omission from the 8 Days a Week film, given his key involvement.
There are a few omissions from that film, to say the least, I think.
I mean,
what are your thoughts on the film itself?
I like the film, but I keep thinking, like, it's there's a definite narrative to it. It's definitely, it feels like it's been quite focus grouped, doesn't it? It has gone through all of the filters of Beatle sign off, and yeah, and I think the colorization is not good. I've seen it done a lot better in a lot of other places. I think there's a bit of a score to settle with that film, isn't there? Because there is, I mean, it's just, it comes from the Stones and a lot of other bands at the time, but there is this kind of whole myth that the Beatles were shit live, which is, as we know, a complete fallacy. But it comes from it. I think they were kind of feeling at the time that they were, their peers were kind of overtaking them live, and were people like the Stones were not shy about telling them, "Oh, we are so much better a live band than you." Now, if you listen to the Stones 65 EP Got Live, if you want it, and you see the film Charlie Is My Dog, you see I mean, it's excitement, there's riots going on stage, it's really good, but it's a different ball game. It's a completely different ball game. So I think they have I think it's very much about them kind of reclaiming their spot, like, as a great live band, and that is what it's kind of geared around, really, more than what the story of it really is.
A lot of people have described it as anthology light, haven't they? But actually, I don't know, they didn't spend enough money on it. You know, this is the Beatles, for goodness sake. Mm. It's got to be the best thing you can make. And it just felt... apparently they spent quite a lot on all the interviews, but the, like you say, the colourisation is woeful. Mm. And some of the archive selection, there's better quality stuff out there. You know, it's just... They shouldn't have allowed... Mm. standards to slip like that, I think, given who they are. I always think that, though, about the Beatles. There's several things like that, you know, that should be, given the quality of their output, everything connected with them should aim to meet that level, in my view.
And if I think it is very much you do kind of, you expect better from them, and this is always been a thing with them, isn't it? You expect better. So it's always a bit kind of odd when you see something that is a little bit substandard or a little bit cobbled together looking. Even things like the rock and roll music compilations, things like that. So they kind of look off because there is just that, not that standard of, you know, sleeve design and things like that there. It is...
Well, even John criticised that, though, didn't he? So you wonder how much input they had in... I mean, how many compilations were there in the 70s and 80s? And I guess they had to get the tick, but I don't think the Beatles really cared. You know, they were trying to pursue their solo careers.
Imagine they turn around and say... They turn around and say no to something. But it's, I find it nuts to think that John, who went to such lengths to kind of get away from it all, was still, you know, almost like the keeper of it all, to turn around and go, no... yes or no to this, and it's really it's a lovely thing that he was so fond of a Hollywood Bowl album, because there's nobody more critical of his
in public than think I mean, we know the hundreds of boxes of tapes that he had. I think he was definitely a huge closet Beatles fan, despite what he said.
But I think in this case, I think, you know, George Emmerich and George Martin, sorry, it's not George Emmerich, is it?
Jeff Emmerich
made, you know, some great choices. I mean, with the editing and the selection of the tracks, I just think, and that's why Giles replicated them all. You know, I just think he got it right.
People.
So let's move on to track two, another one from the same gig, 30th of August 65, She's a Woman.
I absolutely love this. But I love the studio version as well. And it's the B-side of I Feel Fine, of course, as your listeners will know. But it's just such a lovely kind of bold, sparse arrangement. And do you think it's the first time that McCartney really does something different with his voice? Certainly, I can't think of a song before that where he's really played with his voice tonality to quite that degree.
He's done kind of Little Richard at that point, and he's kind of, it's more of a kind of Jackie Wilson kind of thing, isn't it? Him kind of getting off on various kind of like soul R&B records at the time. I love the tune. It's brilliant live. I mean, they know it's brilliant live, and you can't go wrong with the way they play. One of the things that always gets me about She's a Woman is to actually play it. It sounds really basic and really simple, but you've got to do it right. You've got to be completely in that groove. And this is one of the things that always just leaves me kind of like my jaw on the floor about Hollywood Bowl album, is that they can't hear what they're doing.
No.
And Ringo is sat at the back following their asses. Literally. Yep. There is, you know...
Yeah.
They're so tight.
But it swings as well. I mean, to not be able to hear what you're doing and to really kind of be picking up from visual cues, and no matter how, it might be a well-lit venue, it might not be at all. I mean, obviously they can do this kind of stuff in their sleep by this point, but it would be so easy for it to be really stiff, like,
yeah.
But it's not, is it?
And it completely isn't.
You've got a little kind of like contra part from George, kind of ding, 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 yeah. That goes on, and it just all kind of melds together really, really well. And it almost feels like the screams are overdubbed.
Yeah.
And doesn't it build beautifully? That you've got that lovely kind of closed hi-hat groove, haven't you, over the intro, which is not on the record. And then George's guitar coming in, like you say.
Well, George is effectively trying to replicate the piano parts as well, isn't he?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that comes in over Ringo bringing in the kick drum. And it's just lovely little touches like that, and the guitar solo is lovely, and then there's that wig out, which for me could just go on for longer, because I just think that's fantastic. I mean, the I don't know much about the technicalities of singing, but I've heard various live versions, and there's something about the phrasing, the way he sings that, and the soul that he sings it with, and you know, she's a woman right now, that ending, it's just perfect, isn't it? I'll keep the singing to him in a minute.
And it's one of those songs that even at the end they still play well. They can't. Yeah. They somehow can't fuck that one up. They still manage to, even when they're kind of making a bit of a pig's ear of things like Day Tripper and Paperback Writer, because they can't seem to kind of like pull that groove out on stage. They still, She's a Woman, even at Candlestick Park, they've still got it down.
The dynamics in a lot of these songs are really punctuated with a live performance, along with the screams. The screams rise with the dynamics.
When
this kicks off, you are hair at the back of the neck moment.
Yeah, you're just in there, aren't you?
And it's so tight, isn't it, the transition from Twist and Shout to this. What is it, 4 seconds or something? Yeah. And they're straight in. It's brilliant.
I'd like to do a song now that's from an album of ours, an LP album. I'd like to do a song called Dizzy Miss Lizzie. Dizzy, Miss Lizzie, when you rock and roll.
So we move on to track three, which was a composite from the 29th and 30th of August performances. It's Dizzy Miss Lizzy.
I love this. I absolutely, unreservedly adore this. I think if there was like a British version of Nuggets, this belongs on there. I think yes. It absolutely just walks all over the studio version, which is, I think, a little bit... And it, yeah, you can tell it's a little bit rushed, it's a little bit sloppy. This is... I was surprised that it was a cut and shut of two different versions, but, I mean, to be fair, you can... If you can barely feel the join at all, and it's just pure adrenaline. I mean, obviously these are guys who absolutely love 50s and early 60s rock and roll. It's what they always kind of revert to given the chance, and it just completely it just sounds like it's just four guys from Liverpool just absolutely at the top of their game live. I mean, I'm sure there's a certain amount of like scotch and prelude involved, but literally they are, you know, John is absolutely screaming his head off in it. And I think it's just brilliant.
I think you put that beautifully, Martin, because I agree with all of that. I think it feels like a kind of juggernaut of a song, doesn't it? With full throated vocal from John and really, really solid rhythm bed. But I was wondering if I could, before we go on to it, just talk about the intro, because that's the first time we hear them speaking.
Yeah.
And
there's a theme here.
Yeah. Well, it sounds so casual to me and so Liverpool, and there's a kind of worldly wise swagger in John's intro, isn't there? It's a bit weary, maybe, but he's totally unfazed by the audience and it's completely relaxed. and no hint of nerves. And it's probably hugely bolstered by the fact that they've just were hanging out with, you know, one of their biggest heroes of all the night before, Elvis.
Yeah.
But the other thing that strikes me is that, you know, there's no concession made. You know, I kind of imagine that Americans thought of us all talking like Terry Thomas or Dick Van Dyke or something, doing some Cockney chimney sweep. But, you know, he's doing, you know, he's completely Liverpool. If you wouldn't mind indulging me, I am doing a little film at the moment on Liverpool and the Beatles and their relationship with them. And one of the things I've discovered doing that is, even at that time, you know, the Beatles' voices were really unusual in the UK because we very little exposure to Scouse.
Mm.
You know, even there were films set in Liverpool prior to the Beatles emerging, but they tended to use generic northern accents, you know, for understandability, I think. So the fact that, you know, that you've got John here not making any concessions at all. And on a personal note, it just reminds me of my uncles or something, you know, hearing, when I heard that when I was 12, I was thinking, oh, God, how cool is it that you've got someone who sounds like my uncle, you know, king of the world. And made me pretty proud of my provincial roots.
I think the theme I was referring to, because he says, yeah, we'd like to do a song now that's from an album of ours, LP, album.
Album, yes.
And they throughout this, I mean, this is recorded over 2 years, they have no idea what album these songs are on.
Yeah.
Due to Capitol's amazing output throughout the mid-60s. And they make no effort to... You're going to perform in front of thousands of screaming teenagers. At least just have a quick look. Oh, it's off Beatles 65. Nah.
But I actually thought it was because the Americans don't use the term album. They use LP or the other way around.
Mm.
So they kept... But they always had that little slightly goofy... mannered way of doing it, didn't they? You know, a bit of comedy where they pretend that they were a bit hapless and didn't know whether to say album or LP. And, you know, just I think that was a bit of comedy. Like Paul's intro, you know, later where he's sort of doing this mock confusion, which he sounds very kind of convincingly spontaneous, but, you know, he does it every show.
Yeah.
Where George is changing his guitar and he's trying to, yeah, work out what single it was, on whether it was the one before last or the one just before.
And they do that with the films as well. That one was in black and white. This one's one in colour.
Yes.
This one's a coloured one.
Yeah. I would say Dizzy Miss Lizzy is probably a contender for a song that's possibly superior for me to the studio version.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And I think George Harrison does an amazing job on this during the riff. Mm. He's also hitting a fifth note below.
Yeah.
So you're almost getting like a Hendrix-y sounding riff.
And gives it a little bit of that grit, a little bit like the Kinks at the time, or it's very kind of like British Invasion. It's not the kind of like the little nee-nee-nee-nee-nee-nee that you've got on the studio version. Yeah. It's pure grit, isn't it?
And don't they do something interesting with the riff? It goes do 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 do.
Yes,
is that what you mean?
They've changed that. And as well, you think Dizzy Miss Lizzy? I mean, they obviously did it for the BBC sessions. They've been doing it for a while. I think the recording that we get on Help is probably quite rare. After they released that, once they were performing it live, they did make all these amendments. I know, Martin, you were saying that they make all these amendments and just can, you know, gradually filter the songs to how they want to do them, reshape them. Noticeable, I think, in the 66 tour, where you're getting sort of almost psychedelic versions of I Feel Fine. And that kept them interested, perhaps,
throughout
those live tours.
Yeah, actually playing around with riffs and going, okay, they probably kind of, Dizzy Miss Lizzy, they probably actually kind of picked up a boogie riff from somewhere else and going, why don't we just join that one to it, so kind of just tweak this one a little bit. Why don't we do this to it instead? There's definitely a bit of that going on, isn't there? They are still working on their intros, their endings, their little breakdowns, and they're not given any credit for that kind of thing at all.
And just to say, that edit, I think, such a good choice. I mean, that's so much better, that ending with that descending guitar phrase from George, and also John's voice is going, isn't it? I think that's what prompted it.
Yeah.
In the performance from the 30th. But I can't hear the edit. It's great.
I think I can a bit on the 2016 version. I think it's like the ambience changes a little bit in the background, but you'd notice it under headphones, but only under headphones.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I noticed it when I was walking the dog the other day.
Moving on to track 4, Ticket to Ride.
Well, if I was forced to choose a favourite Beatles record, onerous task though that is, the studio version of Ticket to Ride would probably be it, because I just love pretty much everything about it. You know, the thundering drums, the thick bass, the jangling Rickenbacker guitar sound, but most of all, John's vocal. I just think that's probably his best vocal ever, in my view. Just that sigh in the final verse is just sublime. So I actually think that, sadly, this is the weakest track on the album, because I just don't think they could pull that off. I just think they caught, you know, lightning in a bottle that day when they recorded that, and they just couldn't do that on stage with the gear they had.
I think the sheer... I agree that it's absolutely lightning in a bottle, but it's also, this version I think has got a bit something going for it, because it captures the weariness a bit more, the weariness of the vocal, and it sounds a bit strained, that's when you can kind of hear the schedule, the punishing schedule, the tour in it. I mean, John is quite... You can tell he's kind of like, his voice is going a bit, he's struggling with it. But when he gets to the, she says she's living with me, he's bringing her down, that line when he sounds weird, he does, I think that kind of gives it a bit of something. He sounds a bit a bit done, a bit knackered, but not in a kind of, oh, I just want to go home kind of way. But it just kind of, it to me, I think they're both. It's a credible version of it. Nothing's going to match up to that original studio version, but it's got a certain amount of excitement to it, and it has got just that kind of world-weary vocal, which I think...
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. I think it's great. I just think it's just such a high bar.
Yeah.
And the other thing, I think, as your listeners will know, Chris, McCartney did the lead on the studio version, didn't he?
Mm.
And I just think... maybe it's not very Him-ish or something, but I just think George never quite pulls that off. I mean, he does, but it's not played with the same aplomb. And in fact, if you hear other recordings of them doing it live, most of the time, he just muffs it up completely.
Yeah.
And you see McCartney looking over at him. it's fine, but it's given how great the studio version is, I think it's a bit of a pale imitation, really. That was a downer.
Track 5, Can't Buy Me Love.
Joyous. 64 Beatles, height of Beatlemania, walking bass line, surprisingly fast. You can hear Paul straining a little bit, but the guitars on it, it's a perfect advertisement for just spending your entire life with very, very little sleep, being ferried from one thing to the other with endless press conferences where they ask you whether the bubble's going to burst. If that's what comes out the other end of it, it's a great advert, isn't it? It's...
Yeah, what did they do? 30 shows in 29 days or something? Yeah.
Of course, between that, it's just endless receptions, meet and greets, press conferences. I mean, there's a reason Mark Lewisohn is so busy. just enumerating all of this stuff alone. And that is probably, I don't know off the top of my head, but that's got to be probably the height of the mania, isn't it? The sheer amount of stuff they were doing, individual things.
Yeah, I love this too. Everything you said. And also, I noticed that, does Paul insert a little hesitation before the tell me that you want the kind of thing, like
it's almost a little in,
plays with the kind of phrasing, doesn't he, in a lovely way that gives it a kind of makes him have to speed that line up a bit in a really lovely way. It's almost like he knows what he's doing.
He's quite good, isn't he? I think of all of them, he has the most fun on these recordings. He is the one who is at those shows who's just going, I'll try singing it a bit this way, I'll mix around with the phrasing, I'll do a scream or a whoop here, or he's just really enjoying trying different things. The others might be a little bit more kind of like, let's get it done to an extent, but out of all of them, Paul has the most fun with playing around with what his vocal does, I think.
Yeah. And his bass line as well. He's playing a bit of an experimental bass line. And again, George is throwing in a few bluesy chords in there as well that aren't on there. So again, they're just adapting throughout the tours. I've heard this blues chord, let's throw this in a live performance. Probably a lot of these gigs were sort of rehearsals for their next album. In many ways.
I suppose when you think, there is a little bit of a clang, a bit more of a clang on guitars on the 65 tracks, which you could argue carries quite well into Rubber Soul, which I think they start recording very shortly afterwards, don't they? I've not checked my dates, so I don't know if they'd already sat in a bath with like Half the Birds and Peter Fonda at that point, but it's about that time.
Yeah, I think it was on this tour, wasn't it?
Yeah. They're in Hollywood.
Yeah. Mm. Well, there is some interesting stuff going on behind the scenes. And in the 64 one as well, that's when they go to Whiskey A Go-Go with Jane Mansfield, isn't it? And where apparently Lennon punches a DJ who's trying to interview Jane Mansfield about, you know, sitting next to Lennon, and he objects to the fact that it could be starting a scandal. But and luckily that wasn't caught on camera. But it makes you think that they were. It was pretty precarious sometimes. You know, they could have just done something slightly wrong and buggered the whole career up.
I think it's only the speed of the press that stopped them a few times, really. Mm.
Yeah,
because George chucks his drink over some photographer, doesn't he, at the Whiskey a Go-Go, and there's a picture of that, but that's about as negative as it gets, and it seemed justified because he had, you know, a massive flashbulb in his face. If I have to go, you'll be thinking of somehow. Wishing you weren't so far away. And I will remember things we said today.
Track 6, Things We Said Today.
Love this. So this is the kind of electric equivalent of the more acoustic sounding version on Hard Day's Night. Have they picked up the pace quite a bit too?
This does feel a little bit faster, yeah.
And we also have harmonising vocals from George, which I think is a great addition. I don't think it's on the studio version. And then what the other thing they do, which is lovely, is that rousing middle eight section, which is just fantastic.
Which is heralded by a little whoa, little whoop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Actually, all it is really is Ringo loosening his foot on his hi-hat pedal slightly to get a more washy sound with the hats. It's so effective.
Well, I think the screams are almost the percussion as well, aren't they, in some respects? When those dynamics that section explodes, and with the crowd as well.
And again, I think it's another version that possibly surpasses the fantastic studio version.
It's really moody. It's got lovely dynamics to it. It may just burst out, like you say, into that mid-late, where it's a minute kind of takes, comes straight back down again. And yeah, the screams track it, the screams go with it. But yeah, it's no reason why this kind of fallacy about the Beatles not being any cop live is utter bollocks, really, isn't it? Because even in the middle of just this wash of screams, they are able to kind of do this thing with such beautiful kind of up and down dynamics. And it's not, you know, it's not a rock song. It's folk rock before folk rock, really, isn't it? It's more like something the Birds might do a couple of years later. But it's an acoustic tune turned electric, and they give it a really good, thoughtful arrangement. It's a lovely live version. It may well surpass these. I mean, I love the studio version as well, but I think, yeah.
Final track on side one is 23rd of August 1964 performance of Roll Over Beethoven.
This is great. Now, there's a real history in the 60s of bands, usually British bands, doing rubbish versions of Chuck Berry songs, not really kind of getting it. And Roll Over Beethoven is maybe one of the worst kind of offenders in that, because there's a lot of really horrendous versions of Roll Over Beethoven around. I mean, about the worst version I've ever heard is the Birds trying to do it in about 1966, and it's got McGuinn trying to play it on the Rickenbacker 12-string, and it is, oh, forgive my French, it's fucking horrendous. But this version of Roll Over Beethoven, I think it again surpasses the studio version. I think as a live version of it, it gets the song a lot better than a lot of other people trying to play it did at the time. It's got that lovely bit where it's kind of this little breakdown, really, isn't it? Like the verse where Ringo drops back and it's all pretty much just George's vocal and a walking bass line, and then it kind of surges back forward again. And Yeah, that's great. And again, the screens kind of go absolutely nuts when they step it back up again.
And this is George's only vocal on this album. And he used it, according to Mott Lewis and the thing he heard recently, which I didn't know, in the early days of their playing, they used to alternate, you know, all three of them would have a go. But, you know, this is his only vocal, and I think he absolutely nails it.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, you're completely right. It's a much more, it sounds much more self-assured, because I think the guitar on, I mean, I'm not a guitarist, but isn't the guitar a bit more tentative on the album version, whereas this is...
It's much more road polished. He's had a chance to kind of nail it out. I mean, obviously, even at sort of time with the Beatles, things are still very rushed in studio, aren't they? It's not a day in the studio, but it's not much more than that. It's a handful of sessions, and they've still got Brian tapping his watch in the corner. It's very much kind of like, okay, let's capture it, if not move on. Well, there's not a lot in the way of outtakes at that point, is there? There's not a lot from 63. There's bits and bobs from the session with One After 909. Anyway, I don't, what I mean is...
From Me to You and all that.
I've got a whole bootleg CD of that, of all the takes and breakdowns. Yeah, painful. Absolutely painful. But
Ringo's playing here is absolutely great, isn't it? I mean, he's such a good drummer. I was lucky enough to do a documentary series, or work on one, I should say, called The Art of Drumming for Sky Arts a couple of years ago, and that involved interviewing 30 drummers. We travel around the States for a month. It's fantastic, actually. But we interviewed people like Chad Smith from the Chili Peppers, and Ginger Baker, and Clem Burke, and Russ Kunkel, and all sorts of so many of them really rated Ringo's playing, and Chad in particular was rhapsodizing about how hard Ringo hit them in concert, and you know, just what a great drummer he was. And actually have you heard the whole Bernard Purdy thing? So Bernard Purdy, fantastic drummer, doesn't need to do this, but he did. A couple of years ago, he claimed that he played on a number of Beatles.
Well,
he was actually the first person we interviewed, but because he has this reputation for being a bit tricky, the director didn't want to go there. So I never got to the bottom of it. But
I think I know the answer.
Oh, do you? I tend to think it's an old guy being a bit mischievously attention-seeking, isn't it, really? Like a bit like Quincy, you know, and what he was saying about. But yeah, he was so fantastic, and he's great on this.
As we were saying before, the arrangement of this is pretty well the arrangement they played live throughout their career, even before recording it, where they had the dynamics again, as you were saying. She winks like a glowworm, a dance like a spinning top, where they bring it right down and then punch it back in. And the only time on all the bootlegs, whatever, the only time they didn't do that is on With the Beatles.
You're right.
So that's the With the Beatles version is completely, doesn't represent their performance of this at all.
Yeah, isn't that funny? Why would that be?
Strange.
Maybe George Martin just thought they didn't play it that well and said, just keep on playing, just play through. Maybe it's that, I suppose. It's still very early in their relationship as well, isn't it? So he's still kind of feeling them out to a degree.
And then they completely ignored it when they went back onto Rebels. Flipping over to side two, we start with the first Ringo song, and it's Ringo smashing Seven Shades Out of the Drums on Boys.
Now, Boys is just such a weird song, isn't it? It really is like, but it absolutely makes sense, but it shouldn't. It's brilliant, the version of this. It's just pure kind of no messing, bam, power, isn't it? And you know, it's got Ringo kind of growling a bit on the vocal, which is quite unusual.
It's the heaviest track on the album, isn't it?
Absolutely.
By some margin.
Yeah.
And maybe that's because, you know, the drums are being picked up by his vocal mic or something, but it sounds really, you know, the drumming's much heavier in the mix, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's not just the drumming. I mean, they're playing power chords, aren't they? They're going, dang, you know.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
So yeah, it's under 2 minutes long, and I still have no idea why they made Ringo sing Boys, apart from just they thought it might have just been a bit of a laugh.
But have you heard the bootleg version? What's so amazing about the intro to that is Paul's doing this quite long-winded intro, isn't he, while they're getting the boom mic in position and stuff, and it's so apparent how chaotic it was on stage, because Ringo is absolutely bawling over Paul. He's hello, is it on? It's a real demonstration of the fact that, you know, they just couldn't hear themselves, and yet they completely nailed it with this incredible performance. Ringo's on fire.
Yeah, and also they can't hear themselves. Those ridiculously high harmonies as well. Those boys.
They probably thought they were quite loud, though, you know, because it was the first big tour for the US. They were equipped with these, the most powerful backline amps that had ever been made, these AC-100s, which were three times more powerful than the AC-30s they'd used on the UK tours.
That's 65, isn't it? Have they got those?
No, 64.
Oh, I got them that early.
64. Yeah. Yeah, so it was three, you know, but they needed amps about 500 times more powerful to compete with the crowd noise. But I suppose it's all pioneering stuff. But yeah, somehow.
Well, John said in 64, John said the Hollywood Bowl was marvellous. It was the one we'd all enjoyed most.
Oh, right.
I think even though it wasn't the largest crowd, because it seemed so important and everybody was saying things, we got on and it was a big stage and it was great. We could be heard in a place like the Hollywood Bowl, even though the crowd was wild. It's good acoustics.
Yeah.
So I think they could...
Yeah.
It wasn't quite as dramatic as people say, where they couldn't hear a thing.
Yeah. Well, Larry Kane...
Not much.
...said that it had the best acoustics from the 64 tour.
Mm.
But it's eclipsed, isn't it, by... You probably heard about the concert they did at Fulton County Stadium in Atlanta, where when they played there... So that's a 65 tour, so that's a couple of nights after Shea Stadium. And this... local audio engineering company had just gone a bit nuts, really, and bought a whole load of amps that they daisy chained together. So they had 800 watts of power, which was miles more than they'd ever had. And crucially, though, they had speakers pointing back at them for the first time ever, apparently, so they could actually hear what they were doing. Epstein wanted Baker Audio to do the audio, you know, henceforth, but I suppose it was all too late and last minute to get that organised, but it makes you wonder how that might have changed history had the Beatles actually got the kind of fillip that they would have got from being able to hear themselves, you know, at gigs on that tour. And who knows, they may not have stopped touring, and then that would have changed what they recorded after that, wouldn't it?
I've often wondered what might have happened if they had taken a little break and then gone out on tour again in February 1967, and what would they be playing? Would they still be going out and sort of crunching through Babies in Black? Or it's funny, they just don't really try to do any of their 66 repertoire live, do they? They just look, the paperback writer's almost kind of like, oh, we have to do that because that's the single. But
they're completely going through the motions by now, aren't they? I mean, I've heard some podcasters say that they were going through the motions by the time this was recorded, but I don't hear
that at all. No, I don't hear that at all on this.
They're completely committed. No. But I think by 66 they just wanted to get it over with.
Yeah.
When you say about the amplification as well, it's the same thing with the Stones. I mean, they were still touring in 67. Mm. They're kind of a pop band playing heavy pop songs. They took a break in 68. 69, they're a rock band. It's a world
difference. It is a difference. It's very mean. There's a little bit of footage of the Stones in 67, and they're playing this very kind of like gnarly, garagey version of Paint It Black. And that's, I think that's one of the last ones they do. They do a little bit in 68. They play one gig, I think, Enemy Party. But in 69 they go out. They've not only is the lineup change, but it is a very different thing, and they've got serious amplification.
And this is all hastened by the Beatles, isn't it? And it's the cost of being first, isn't it? Really, that we're suffering from a bit here. But you know, the other way of looking at it is: would we have had Pepper and the White Album?
Yeah.
You know, had they been committed to months and months on the road? I think it worked out just fine.
We'd like to do a song now from the first film we made, and it was in black. The one that we made in black and white, we've only made two. One was black and white, and one was coloured. Well, this is the black and white one. And it's a title song from the film. La la la. Great. And it's called Hard Day's Night. It's been a hard.
Track 2, 30th of August, 65, Hard Day's Night.
Love this. I love the intro as well. Just,
oh, yeah.
it's just really playing with it now, isn't he? And again, it's comedy feeling, isn't it, while George changes his guitar to the 12th string to get that distinctive Hard Day's Night sound.
And it's got an actual. They couldn't just fade out on the. They couldn't do a fade out like on the record, so it actually just ends on like a big bang, big chord, doesn't it?
Mm.
And don't you love the singing? I mean, you know, they're really both going for it, aren't they? And that little overlap between Paul and John when they're going back from the middle eight to the verse again.
And absolutely going for it, and you can hear. That their voices are both starting to pack in a little bit, but they are still both going for
in a good way.
In a good way, yeah. Paul could clearly do with like a bottle of water when he does. but no, it's Beatlemania 101, isn't it? It's just pure exertion. It sounds great.
And Chris, you're a guitarist. Is that guitar solo tricky? Because he plays it flawlessly.
For me, yeah.
I'm a guitarist too.
Ask someone who's good at guitar.
Sorry,
no, that's all right.
What do you think?
I'm a retired guitarist.
Should we give it a go?
Oh, all right, here we go.
What key is it in? Does anybody know?
G.
No, I do.
Hang on. Yeah, it's really hard.
Yeah,
it's really good.
Well, it's dub. I mean, it's on a 12th string, isn't it? So you've got. So he's actually playing it an octave lower. But it's, so that's probably a bit. That's probably slightly easier to play. But so ding 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 ding. I'm actually doing it.
No one saw you, Martin.
Fucking sad, am I? I've got a guitar in my room, but I'm not going to go and get it.
But yeah, it's. Hang on, what are we talking about? That's completely deleted me.
We're talking about Hard Day.
I think the interesting thing for me is this, is because it's recorded in 65, and in their personal lives, I mean, they're smoking pot for breakfast, I think was the quote that they said in Anthology.
Yeah.
And there's a certain, the way they're singing this, it's kind of like men singing a song written by boys, but they're still enjoying
it. It's a long time for them, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's... Okay, so it's like this is a song we did last year, and for them that's just ancient history. That's and things have moved on so much at that point. Absolutely, they are kind of getting absolutely baked for breakfast, and you've had the dental incident by now. Things are very, very different. But if you think about it, what did you do last year? Oh, I went to Cornwall.
Yeah.
You know, it's what did they do last year?
A million other
things. What are you doing this time last year? It's so it's so accelerated, isn't it? And this is why I suppose we're obviously all massive Beatle nerds, but you look at a picture of Beatles and you can kind of pretty much date it to a month.
Do you think the other thing as well that I really noticed recently, just looking at their performances on YouTube, there's a huge difference between the way they move even in 63 to the way they move in 64. There's a lot of head wobbling from Paul and Ringo.
Yeah.
Which they've obviously seen on TV and thought, that's a bit too much. I'll dial that. You know, they're continually calibrating their performance and making it a little bit more slick. Obviously, very aware of what they look like and how they could make it look better. And I guess the same completely applies to...
But John and George remain the same.
Yeah, they're more similar, aren't they? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
Even on Revolution film footage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
John, apart from a few snarls here and there, that's his posture that he did in The Cavern. Same with George. Yeah.
Interesting.
The guitar's a little lower, but that's a change, really.
Track 3, Help.
Oh, after you, Moss.
And this is like the 1-2 punch, isn't it? So it's like, we are doing our film songs now. And I think it's a great version of Help. Again, a little bit weary. And there's one bit where John's voice almost kind of...
Yeah.
Does he just get the giggles, or does he... is it just give out a bit?
I think he chokes on his words, doesn't he? I don't know if he's almost laughing at the absurdity of it.
Absolutely, I noticed that. And that's in the bit where the drums drop out, isn't it? And I think that's so lovely, though. I just think, it for me, it feels like so evocative of... it sums up their love and friendship, I think, somehow. And the joy that they got from playing together. And the euphoria of being at the peak of their powers. I think that really, humanises the performance in such a lovely way. That touches me anyway, every time I hear it.
I think as well, when you consider what the song's about, him going through his Fat Elvis stage and starting to feel a bit insecure about things, it's a lovely, there's so much character to it as well, and it's a little human moment on a stage in front of 17,000 screaming teenagers and it's just this massive, opulent venue. I mean, I suppose maybe it's just him kind of looking at it and thinking, fuck me, this is absolutely...
Seeing himself. I was also wondering whether he was laughing, because there's a line a bit before that he normally flubbed in live versions.
Mm.
And maybe he just had a look from Paul pulled a funny face or something, or there's some in-joke.
Pretty well every live performance of this, he's fluffed the lyrics on.
Yeah.
Bless him.
And when you're in a band of your mates who are arch piss takers like the Beatles, when you kind of, I never needed any help in any, if you're looking around, they're probably taking every opportunity to just kind of just psych you out, aren't they? Just to try to, let's see if we can make him drop it.
I wonder if at the time, because it's years later, he said, I was singing Help. The lyrics are a lot darker, but he introduces it as a light little ditty called Help.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that's almost a piss take.
It's sending like himself
none
up.
Of you understand.
Yeah.
You all think it's a light little ditty, but I'm bearing my soul.
Yeah. And I love the way he says,
"Go away with that light, will you?"
And it's sort of, what is that? Sort of Yorkshire accent or something.
Yeah.
Lancashire.
That was his generic generic northern accent.
That's like the voice he puts on in Magical Mystery Tour, because he spends most of that just in this, for no apparent reason, just in this kind of fairly broad Yorkshire accent, doesn't he?
And how the heck the spotlight follower guy understands enough to stop shining it on him from that. Oh, God only knows.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Remember, I'll always be true. And then while
So we move on to track four, another one from 23rd of August 64. It's All My Loving.
I love it. Absolutely love it. I love the...
So fast.
And the George harmony for me completely makes it. And it, is that, by the way, because the John would have done it normally, but the 16th note triplet rhythm guitar thing that he's doing is just really quite challenging. And
it's not George doing the harmony, is it? No. Paul shifts up to the harmony and George shifts to Paul's note part.
Yeah. Okay. After the guitar
solo.
So
he actually sings. Yes, he. I think it, I'm not sure how he did it in studio, but it.
Well, Paul was double tracked in the studio. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it's maybe just too tricky for John to doing that kind of tribute thing, which is. It's still impossible to play. That fast guitar triplet is just ridiculous, and the walking bass on it as well. It's just wonderful, and it's another firm finger up to the Stones. I love the Stones, I really do, but they're wrong on this. When they say we're a better band than you, like no. Nah, man,
I always try and have at least one Mick Jagger impression in me. Thank you. George was definitely. You can imagine the conversation. John, John, can you cover for me when I go up to do the harmonies in the song? No, I'm playing. What is it? 32 strums a second or whatever it is. So, George.
easier for him to do. I suppose might be another reason perhaps why he started to feel a little bit kind of like, underappreciated in the scheme of things, because he is completely the one that is pulled out to sing vocal parts that he wouldn't normally, and to can you do the piano bit from She's a Woman on guitar, please, George? He is absolutely just kind of tooling away at all this stuff in the background. Oh, I want to play lead on this single, but you can...
He's kind of the Mal Evans of the Beatles. George, can you just come and...
he is upper Mal.
The next song we're going to sing is an oldie. Some of you older people might remember. It's from last year, and it's called She Loves You.
And the penultimate track on this album, She Loves You, another one from August 64.
Yeah, so I love this kind of lugubrious sounding intro from John that some of you older people might remember. And it's obviously light-hearted, but it's indicative of how quickly they're advancing, A huge hit from 12 months ago is an oldie. It's dismissed as that.
And also, perhaps in the back of their minds a little bit, like, when does this expire? I think it's maybe not long after this they start to get the, okay, we are here for the long run. But they're being permanently asked, when does the bubble burst? There's a whole bit about it in that Craig Brown book. So it's probably a million, it feels like a million years ago for them. I mean, it's a year. It's just crazy.
Crazy. The song itself, though, for me, this is the best track on the album. So I just think it's so tight. I can't quite put my finger. I love She Loves You, the studio version, but there's something about there's something in the studio version that's slightly sugary, and this doesn't seem to have that, and it just sounds fantastic to me.
Is it the actual fact that we're getting a stereo version as well as being a live version, and it really highlights like George's intricate guitar work. It just opens it up a lot more, perhaps.
Joyous energy, isn't it?
It's joyous, absolutely joyous energy. But again, with them, it's a year's hindsight as well. How many more Scotch and Cokes and Ciggies have they put away in that year as well? So it's probably a little bit less sugary, partly because of that. And how many times have they performed it? But it is one. I mean, it's just pure bottled excitement, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's so tight. Yeah. That, from that counting, one, two, and then straight into There's a funny bit in the Let It Be, maybe it's the outtakes actually, where McCartney's reminiscing with the other guys about when Jimmy Nicol was in the band and he did that 1-2 counting. And Jimmy wasn't there because he was so kind of beguiled. So he had to say 1-2 about five times before Jimmy finally got started playing.
This next song will have to be our last one for this evening. Yes! Oh, yes! You know, sorry, but... So, we'd like to thank everybody here tonight for coming along. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. And we all hope that you've enjoyed the show. Have you enjoyed the show? Good. Great. Lovely. Thank you very much. And we'd like to finish off with a song which was recently on one of our albums over here. It's an old Little Richard song and it's called Long Tall Sally. I'm not a telling baby. Daddy had to make me body down.
So we end with a 23rd of August performance of Long Tall Sally.
This is great. It's got Paul's kind of, oh, we've got to go. No, we've got to, you know, we've really got to go. Really kind of like absolutely hamming it up for the crowds who are just hanging on his every syllable. But yeah, and again, it's another example of a really, you know, just a really great live version as well, because they've got the tricky on the instrumental break where they're sort of doing the climb up. And again, it's just, I mean, it's the kind of song that you could only really put at the end, because otherwise you're not going to have a voice afterwards, are you?
He does that thing where he strikes the bass at the very beginning, doesn't he, to get the note, and then really lets rip. They know what they're doing, don't they?
Paul especially. I mean, Paul is the consummate showman. Mm. I mean, we hope you enjoyed the show. Have you enjoyed the show?
Yeah. You know, it's... Meanwhile, they're all wetting
themselves.
Who knows
what he's doing?
And Ringo, he just goes ballistic in the final verse, doesn't he? He's hitting everything to work them into even more of a frenzy, if that's possible.
And that's one of the reasons why I love it's real Max Schaal music, isn't it? It always felt to me like what Hamburg would have been like, but with more screaming, a bit less language.
There's footage of them, I think it's the Washington gig in 64, where they're playing this, and Ringo's hands at the end are a blur. He's just astonishing what he's playing on this song.
Yeah, completely. It's one of the things I really noticed looking at that big photo that there is in the gatefold sleeve, staring at Ringo, and his hands are all a blur on that picture. And he does feel, he's a real kind of kinetic force of nature in this. It's brilliant.
So thank you very much, chaps. I guess we should mention, obviously, the 2016 version, which had four extra bonus tracks. You Can't Do That, I Want to Hold Your Hand, Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby, and Babies in Black. So do these add anything, do you think? Obviously, we're getting new Beatles material.
It's nice to have them. I mean, it does feel a bit removed from the other version, because this is obviously the 8 days a week version. It sounds a little bit more polished in places. I think it's great to have it. It feels odd having those extra tracks there, just because you're so used to having it in this order, in this track listing. But they don't diminish it at all. I mean, I love the version of Babies in Black in particular, because that's always... You must think it must be an absolute sod to sing anyway, but it's funny. It's strange how they kind of cling to that one throughout playing live. It's an unusual choice, but it's kind of like a garage waltz.
They love the way their vocals worked on it, I think, didn't they?
But I
love that too. And actually, I Want to Hold Your Hand, they've done a great job on the remix of that one in particular. I think, because I think that did sound a bit thin or weak, because you would ordinarily that would have been included in the 77, wouldn't it, given that was the big breakthrough hit. But I think they've made the right choice not to include it then, but what Giles has done to it does bring it up a lot, I think.
yeah
And George gets another vocal.
All I would add to that, I would say the biggest omission was the 30th of August version of I'm Down, which I'm guessing they left off as they fluff one of the verses. They just go out of time. But other than that, it's an astonishing performance in, again, super stereo. And it was how they left that off, I have no idea. That would have been such a more powerful addition to those bonus tracks, I think.
I guess it's just if it's something that's got a fluff in it, I mean, particularly with that narrative at the moment, we are a great live band. And that's the thing they're pushing. If they were to kind of end it up with something like that, which did have what they saw as like a glaring fuck up in it, then it would, that kind of punches it.
People with their pants down.
I think the 2016 version is a good complement to it. It doesn't replace the screaming mania of the original. And you've got two gigs, like a year, well, three gigs really, a year apart, and it's still, it doesn't feel jarring at all when they skip. All of a sudden, side two just kind of suddenly just skips back a year for the last three tracks and stays there. And there's nothing jarring about it at all, is there?
Do you think it was always their intention to record it in exactly the same way in case they wanted to use it that way? Because it seems odd in a way that they didn't learn from the recordings in 64 and thought, well, they're not as great as they could be. Why don't we use some more mics and a more, a bigger tape machine?
But I think the guy who recorded Voyle Gilmore, I think he'd done the Beach Boys concert album around about the same time. And that was obviously a certain amount of teen hysteria, but nowhere near as much. And was probably thinking, okay, this is more manageable. And also with a band who pretty much made everything in mono anyway, what's the issue there? Probably thinking Capital, it's just another band. That's probably the thinking behind it. They didn't realise what they were dealing with, I think, when they set it up.
Yeah.
So Chris and Martin, thank you so much. How would you sum up this album? What does it mean to you?
It's pure Beatlemania, isn't it? It's them playing live and enjoying themselves. And I've obviously uncovered any amount of live performances over the years, from the very, very good to the very, very, some of the stuff from 66 is wince-worthy, but it's them, I think it's the last time they are playing music that they are absolutely comfortable with doing on stage, and is really recent for them. I mean, it all changes very rapidly afterwards. A lot of stuff on, you could probably get away with things like The Word live, and It's definitely a moment in time. It's probably the last time they are really, really involved in just being pure Beatlemania Beatles, and absolutely they're enjoying it. There's no downside. It's two three great gigs, and I think the fact that you've got the screams up so high as well, it's just a captured moment in time.
Yeah, I echo all of that. Pure joy. I think it's hugely significant for me. As I said earlier, it's the first LP I ever owned. It's a present from my elder brother. And on a rather sad but cosmic note, I lost my brother back in January. And today's his birthday.
I'm so sorry.
So I think it's, quite fitting, really, that we're talking about this album, because that he's a big bridge to the Beatles for me, and this album has huge resonance to me personally because of that. So great to be talking about it.
Ah, what a privilege. This one's for
him.
Thank you. So Chris Purcell and Martin Roddick, thank you so much for your
time. Thank you so much, Chris.